This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Hello, and welcome to the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. Today I've got an interview with James Lance, who is the designer of Invisible Ink, and he works at Clay. He also designed a roguelike game called Mercury, which I've said is like the best roguelike. It's like the most like boiled down essential roguelike ever. We talk a little bit about that. We talk about a lot of topics. We go in depth on this issue of how games are marketed, how strategy games should be marketed, like the kinds of decisions that you have to make in order to communicate to people like that your strategy game is good. We talked a lot about League of Legends. We talked about a few other things. You may also know his father is James, is Frank Lance. James' father is Frank Lance, who has been on this podcast twice, also a game designer. So we talked a little bit about that at the end. I'm excited to bring this podcast to you. And I also want to say that if you have been following my blog, you should definitely check out. I've been doing videos recently. I've been switching from articles to doing videos on game design. So from now on, pretty much whenever I'm going to make an article, I'm just going to at least, you know, just speak into a mic and read it aloud. I will also always offer the transcript, but that's something I've been doing. It just seems like more of a conversation happens around videos these days than like the conversation is happening on YouTube on pretty much almost every subject. So, and articles, I think this is one of maybe the explanations for why game design writing has kind of gone away somewhat, is because YouTubing has sort of replaced it somewhat. So anyway, please look for those on YouTube, subscribe to me on YouTube. If you're not already a Patreon patron, definitely do that. The Patreon is going better and better and better. We are getting kind of close to my second goal. So anyway, please check that out. Without further ado, please enjoy this interview with James Lance. I do want to talk a little bit about just your background and how you came to work for Clay. For people who don't know, they're the team that made Don't Starve and Shank, and then I think you came on after those, right?
Yeah, right after Don't Starve, or right around when Don't Starve was launching.
Right, and so your first game with them was Invisible Ink, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And what have you worked on with them since?
I worked on a bit of one of the new projects, which is called Hot Lava, mm-hmm. Which is sort of a game built around jump maps in Counter-Strike, mm-hmm. Which is super cool, and it's like nostalgia-filled, and I worked on some levels for that in the early prototype phase. And then I moved on to Don't Starve Together, which is the multiplayer DS project, and worked on that for a while.
Cool. Yeah, I saw Hot Lava. I thought that was a really good, that's like a really good theme for a game, like that floor is lava kind of concept.
Yeah, it's pretty genius. Mark, the guy who's working on it, is like such a, he's so tapped into, you know, just what people want to upvote on Reddit and what people want to talk about, and it like he found this idea that's just like hotcakes to people, you know?
Sure, yeah. So how did you come to like work for them? Like give me like a little bit of your background, like where, you know, what did you go to college, I assume, for something?
Yeah, I went to Hampshire College, which is a liberal arts school, kind of like a hippie school, and I did game design there, and I learned how to program there. While I was there, I had a couple independent projects I just wanted to make a video game, you know, mm-hmm. Like my first video game that was going to be successful in some way. And, you know, I could put on the internet and have a decent amount of coverage for whatever reason. And of course that didn't work even a little bit. You know, I didn't realize how hard it was to get people to talk about your video game. Mm-hmm. And I also,
was that Mercury, by the way?
No. So Mercury was actually relatively successful on that front. But I spent like a year and a half just making these games, making a couple iPhone games. I made some weird, like I spent 6 months making some weird real world kind of like almost an area code game. You know, because I was talking to my dad at that point.
Sure.
And he was working on a lot of these like real world games. And I was like, OK, the real world games are where it's at.
Right.
But I don't know. I mean, you know, it didn't work out for me. And then I came home and I was like, geez, like I feel awful. I spent like 2 years of my life making these games and no one's talking about them. No one cares about them. You know, no one even at school, no one cared about them. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I have this idea. And so I made Mercury in about like, I think 5 days. And I was like so upset. And I was just trying to grind stuff out at that point. I was like getting, you know, really frustrated. And then Mercury was like for me, a personal breakthrough, even though, you know, maybe 200 to 1,000 people actually played it. Mm-hmm. You know, people were interested in it and people were compelled by it. And so I took that and I took my college degree and I got a job at a company that makes iPhone games. It was actually John and Brenda Romero's company.
Oh, really? You worked there? Was that Loot Drop?
Yeah, Loot Drop.
Okay, and that. So, what project did you work on there? Is the Commander?
The Ghost Recon project.
Yeah, yeah.
And then some unannounced thing that I don't think ever came out. You know, it was like Facebook game. I think it did come out, but I think it was like right around the time when Facebook games are dying. Uh-huh. So, it came out to no one playing it. I believe.
Sure, sure, yeah.
And then that company, you know, had to downsize a bit, and I was looking again and I ended up at Clay. I just started calling up companies that I was interested in.
And Clay is in Canada, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
So you had to like actually move to a new country.
Yep. Yeah. I made a short list and I just hounded everyone on that. I was like Double Fine, Clay, you know, there's the standard short list you would make if you were an indie guy looking for the best indie companies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I talked to Valve and they were like, do you know C++? And I was like, nope. And they were like, okay, not interested.
Aww.
And then, no, I mean, it's good. I like working at Clay. And,
no, yeah, it's it seems like a kind of the right size of a company that seems like not, like, I feel like you probably, now what's your role there actually? Like,
oh God, yeah, Clay's great. It's a really good size, and the teams are kept really small, which is one of the super successful things.
Mm-hmm.
My role there is basically all the designers at Clay are programmers.
Okay.
So I'm like a designer / programmer. I spend most of my days programming.
Gotcha.
But technically, I'm a designer.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's just like shitloads of legwork that has to be done in terms of programming. So
yeah, especially when you have like your teams are 4 to 8 people, mm-hmm. you know, or 4 to 12 people.
That's like that is like the perfect number. Like you sort of slightly bigger than band size. I tend to go for like band size, but that's because I just have no resources. If I had some resources, I would go for like band, rock band. Size times like plus 4 or 5 exactly, plus roadies basically. Yeah,
there you go, exactly. That's what you mean.
So that's really cool. So is it a kind of situation where like could you like propose a new project and like actually have that be like a real thing, or is that something you've already done, or like was it
for sure? Yeah, I've worked on a couple solo projects at Clay, and it's it totally works that way. Basically, if you can get other people at Clay, you know, there's a little bit of a Valve thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get other people at Clay interested in what you're working on, then you can have a project get off the ground.
Gotcha.
It's not quite as like wheel your desk over as Valve proposes to be. I mean, I don't know how Valve actually works on the inside.
Right.
But at Clay, it's certainly some combination of what people want to work on, what's interesting to work on, and then a certain amount of, you know, what we have to work on for our community and our fans. And, you know, even if, you know, no one wants to do whatever maintenance for Project X, then sometimes we do it for a year or two anyway, because, you know, we don't want to abandon a project and stuff like that.
Sure. Yeah, I should mention, by the way, that the game I brought up earlier, Mercury, like, I still consider that. That was the thing that, like, really put you on my radar when I saw that. It was, I found that so impressive. To me, I still think it is, like, the ultimate roguelike in a lot of ways. Because, like, you sort of really boiled down to the essence of how roguelikes really work, especially in that original version of it. I remember you also had this other idea for it, which I think you thought was the best thing about it, and maybe it is the most, like, attention-grabbing thing about it. And this actually goes into our larger conversation that I want to have. But yeah. So you had that idea where, like, players could, like, what was it? They could, like, propose items or, like, make their own items, something like that?
Every week, the top two players on the leaderboard added a monster and item to the
That's
game.
Right. That's
and
right.
So it's funny, the simple version of the boiled down roguelike was actually intended only to be like a template for the, you know, the future stuff that players were going to put
right.
into the game.
Right. And I totally understand how, like, to most people that would seem like, I don't know, like, who cares? But and the other thing, the oh wow, I can propose an item and like create these new items if I'm on the top of the leaderboard, like, that seems really cool, and to most people. But I feel like, and so that's the big conversation that we wanted to talk about today, really, was like this sort of you know, like, two things being not in sync of, like, what systems designers understand to be important about strategy games and what just the general community, the gaming community, values, and what can you use to market a game and what can't you use?
It's funny because I think Mercury is almost, in a lot of ways, it's a perfect example because, what you're saying too, but also because it's also the other thing that I've been thinking about in addition to those things is, like, The thing you like in Mercury, which I think is like the goblin creature, it's got like, it's just like, it's a little goblin dude, and I gave it a certain amount of health, and I boiled it down, and it's got a super basic, like, turn counter, and then every five levels you reset health, I think. Yeah,
there was some, like, little system there. It was like it was just a really nicely tuned little system that kind of expresses what the way that roguelikes work, this basic risk reward kind of mechanism in roguelikes, but with, like, 1/10 the rules.
Yeah, but it's funny because the funny thing about that to me is that I made that, like, completely by accident. Like, that's okay. Not intentional design, and I didn't do it. There was one intentional design in that, which was that there was a monster each level that was a score bonus monster, mm-hmm. that it would give you a score multiplier if you found it and killed it. That mm-hmm. was, like, the only actual design I did on that game. Everything else was just placeholder values. And so the fact that it worked is, like, good. I'm happy with that, but it's also extraordinarily anxiety-inducing because it's, like, why did that work and how do I recreate that, you know, in other games? And it, you know, how much of being a systems designer for me, maybe less so for you, but for me, a lot of it's like just a shot in the dark.
Well, yeah, but your shots in the dark are also coming from, you are a person who knows games, you've been designing games for a long time. It's kind of like, you know, when Jimi Hendrix is improvising and he, you know, plays a note, it's like, it's not just a shot in the dark. I mean, he knows what he's doing, you know what I mean? Like, even if he doesn't, he can't verbally, there's a difference between verbally being able to express why you did what you did and it being just this random occurrence, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're right. No, it does make sense to compare me to Jimi Hendrix.
I think
that's reasonable.
That's where I'm going. I do think that's a good. So, did you have that? So basically, the topic is like, systems designers, how do we communicate what we want, our value to people? And because I think that, like, it's especially in terms of marketing and talking about the game, because, like, you know, you can't just say, oh, I have this game. It's really deep. It's really elegant. It's like one of these, because we both, like, agree that we really value these values of, like, these really high ceilings for mastery, you know, games that can turn into lifelong habits, I think you said. And
kind of a Daniel Cook kind of thing. Yeah.
Exactly. And like I think of it as like games as a discipline. Like, you know, I play the guitar, or I play Go, or I play, you know what I mean? It's like, it's a facet of a person's life. And in order to do that, they need to have a certain amount of, like, integral you know, strength. And but that integral strength, or that integrity, or that evergreen quality, is not at all something that you can market a game with, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And in fact, in a lot of ways, I think a lot of the times it hurts the marketing of the game, actually, if you do it wrong. Like, you have to hide it, I think. You have to, like, cover it up with sticks and hope people fall into it, you know?
That's a really good way of putting it, yeah. Yeah, because people see it as sort of a buzzword. Like, if you say the word deep, people are like, what does that mean? I don't know what that means. Therefore, it's just like, you might as well be saying blast processing or something.
Yeah, that too, but also it just the numbers, like, if your game has depth, it often has a lot of, like, it's going to have a lot of different things that have different properties to them, you know, like items with a bunch of different stats and properties, and it can be quite intimidating for someone to just stumble on that and see a game, and then it's just filled with numbers everywhere and different types of things, and it's constantly explaining new mechanics, and maybe that's what it needs to be a deep game, but at the same time it does. I think it's hard to create depth without being intimidating. In fact, I think that's the hard part of being a systems designer. I think it's actually relatively easy to create a certain amount of depth, maybe not like evergreen depth, but it's relatively easy to make a project a little bit deep. The hard part is creating something super deep that's also relatively simple and easy to understand.
Right. I mean, I would go even further. I'd say it's very easy to just create depth if that's right. All you care about. If you have right. No concern about whether anyone will ever be able to access this depth, then, you know, it's easy. Just do like 50 by 50 go or something, you know, like that kind of, that sort of thing. So to me, the design process is always a sort of balancing of accessibility and depth, and so that is what's hard about being a systems designer. I definitely agree with that. So with Invisible Ink, did you like, because was this something on your mind when you were like thinking about that and how that would be marketed, and like what can you talk a little bit about that, and like, because that also was a really interesting game that did really different things. It took like the sort of XCOM squad based thing and just kind of really did some dramatically different stuff, got rid of like the dice roll combat, which is pretty huge actually. It's pretty central to how those games work. So, you know, it became a completely different kind of thing. I don't know, did you start with like XCOM as like the starting point for that?
Yeah, absolutely. The original game was basically XCOM with heist, more or less. It was all dice rolls, combat, turns, you know, combat modifiers, damage, health. Absolutely. Tons of guns. It had originally just tons and tons of guns. We were definitely thinking about that the entire time. And I think with every game I design now, I'm going to be thinking about that, where it's like, you know, more and more I do think about what it's going to take to make people play this game and if they're going to be interested in it. Invisible Ink had you have to worry about it a little bit less, I think, at somewhere like Clay. Because there's a marketing budget, a little bit, to a certain extent. Definitely less so at Clay than anywhere big. But, you know, at least Clay has, like, Don't Starve players, and you know, there's a decent amount of buzz around any project that you make there, and you can get the art is really good at Clay, and people like it. It's stylish and cartoony in a pleasant way.
Yeah.
And so you get all that for free, or free, from my point of view, you get
sure,
all that
for free, right? It's automatic.
Yeah. You know, obviously, that's because Clay has built up this big thing and has great artists and all that stuff. But, yeah, I think we thought about it a lot and we worked really hard on it to make it accessible. But we could have done much, much more. And actually, the biggest failing of Invisible Ink isn't – we never even got to the point where gameplay could be an issue as the biggest failing. It just didn't – it sold pretty well, just fine. But it did not, like – do as well as I was hoping it would do. And I think the main reason for that is just because we misidentified what people wanted to play. Like, we created this Spelunky like system where, you know, you get into a game and you play it for 2 hours and you die and then you have to restart. Mm-hmm. And I guess like FTL, Spelunky, and we kind of thought that was what we thought that genre still existed. Mm-hmm. And now looking back on it, I'm not convinced it does. I think FTL and Spelunky are, well, FTL specifically is in a league of its own. And I think trying to mimic it in that sense does not work, because Spelunky kind of works still because it's like short and it's actiony.
Right.
So you can still make like Spelunky, Rogue Legacy, Crypt of the Necrodancer, that kind of stuff. But for FTL, like a 2 hour long game that you restart, I think FTL is a weird thing. And I think we didn't recognize that.
Hmm.
And in fact, I think the one change I would make to Invisible that I believe would make it like 10 times as many people play it. Would be to make it an XCOM or Darkest Dungeon style experience where it's just, it's a 40 hour game. You have like a roster of agents and you never lose the game.
And you can always like reload and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. And it's got this kind of meta where you're like constantly coming back to your base. Like basically just XCOM, right? Where it's like 40 hours long, 50 sure. hours long instead of 2 hour roguelike kind of things.
Yeah.
And the reason I care is just because I'm proud of that game and I want to reach as many people as possible with it. And I also think another thing that's important about trying to make your games popular if they're deep is that people genuinely get value from talking to other people about playing deep games.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big part of games like Spelunky and Hoplite and FTL is, you know, like if you have enough players, it actually generates additional value for the players who are playing your game. They get to talk to people about it. They get to enjoy it on a deeper level because they're validated in thinking about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, definitely. I mean, you know, yeah, that's definitely a thing. And not only that, but I also think that like, you know, that truly great games require like an incredible amount of resources just in terms of time, in terms of balancing, in terms of redesigning whole systems and like, you know, coming back to it. Basically the kind of stuff that Riot is doing with League, like that's the kind of stuff I tend to think is important for strategy games. But like unless you have a successful game, it's just like not feasible to do that. You just can't really do that with a game that, you know, is not like doing the kind of stuff that, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, so I think that on two axes, yeah. I agree with what you're saying about the social factor. It's kind of like a tree falling in the woods, if, you know, in a sense, if like nobody is playing your game and it's really great, like, who cares? But also at the same time, you know, your game becomes great because it had the resources, because it was popular. So like in a yeah. way, it might be a very smart thing for systems designers to be like, all right, first, how do I make a thing that will be popular and that is like kind of enough of a husk of a strategy game that I could that I could like mold it once it's popular into something great and people won't really. You know what I mean? Like, I think, I mean, that's what I would say League kind of was. I mean, you know, like when it started, it was like, ugh, it was really not appealing.
Yeah. It was a free to play Dota clone for sure. And
yeah.
It felt like it. Yeah.
Right. And so that's a really interesting kind of different way to think about things. And I totally agree with you, by the way, on the 2 hour long roguelike concept. I mean, to me, that's like strange. And I actually think it's funny because Civ, as popular as Civ has always been, it's kind of the same situation. I mean, it's not really a roguelike because I guess you can just always reload and it's quick saving every turn or whatever. But like it still has this issue of like a 6 hour long match of something. Like if you think of a Civ game as like a match, like a competitive game, which it kind of is. And then it's like so long and so much of it is just like downtime. And so it's just, those kind of forms just don't make sense to me. I think I agree with you that like Invisible Ink, the best, like here's the like front facing mode is like an XCOM-y campaign. And then you could also have like a mode that's like a short little competitive, you know, some kind of like something more roguelike-y, but like a lot shorter than 2 hours. I don't know.
I think it would have been so much more successful if we had done that, and so much probably better too, to be honest, probably a better game. I think really FTL is just too good. It was like FTL is abnormally good, and so it tricked us into thinking that it was a genre when in reality it's just a really good game that happens to have this wacky kind of like 2 to 2 hour long roguelike structure.
And I think it's given some leeway because there are games that, like I said, like Civilization, those 4X games, and even XCOM, like
I think a lot of people don't really necessarily make the distinction that we're making in terms of the difference between a 4-hour roguelike and a 4-hour campaign-y kind of, right. You know what I mean? Like a
yeah, lot, absolutely. Until yeah. they lose, and then they realize the difference.
Right, sure. That's true. So anyway, yeah, Invisible Ink, I think that system is really cool, and I don't know, do you ever think that you and or Clay will go back to it?
Oh, thank you. Well, we made a DLC. I think we could go back to it and make Invisible Ink 2 and make it the XCOM. I think we would make it the XCOM thing. Mm-hmm. Or the Darkest Dungeon kind of thing. I don't think we will. It's possible, for sure.
Right.
But in general, we haven't been making sequels. Just because it's more fun to make new stuff.
Sure. Well, yeah, and you know, you're going to have a new that big of a game design shift of like yeah. is going to inform other things. It's going to inform the theme and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think if we were going to make sequels, it would be of more like some of our more successful games, probably.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Actually, I think we've talked a little bit before about League of Legends, and haven't we? I think we have.
Yeah, definitely, for sure.
Yeah, so about how it's I've been I wanted to talk to you a little bit about it, because I know you have a lot of strong opinions about it.
I do.
I'm also like this close to getting Greg Street on the podcast. He might be the next person, so that would be really cool. If you have any questions you want me to ask him, let me know.
Okay, yeah, I will.
I'm pushing for them to we've talked a little bit about like last hitting in those games and like the
yeah.
haven't we? I thought yeah, that was the conversation.
Yeah,
we did.
Yeah.
So I think, and I think your position on it was like, yes, it's bad, but it serves a very important function in the game. Is that right?
No, I think it's good. I just flat out think it's good.
Okay, I guess this is maybe a point that we can make, like, have a little bit of a game design argument.
Oh, let's go, yeah.
Yeah, so to me it seems bad that in a strategy game like that, where you kind of have to go into the custom games and just sit there and practice last hitting, like, if you do that, you're just going to, like, kind of go up a few ranks, like, period.
Absolutely,
and
yeah, no question.
And, like, it seems bad to me that you can just bring in that one, like, really separate skill. Like, kind of like if there was, like, I don't know, a list of, like, 250, like, numbers that you could memorize. Or, like, I mean, I guess that kind of is in League of Legends, but that's a bad example. But, like, I don't know, if you could, like, what was it? There was, like, a chess boxing or something. It's, like, one of those things where you, like, combine two completely unrelated skills and you can bring this other skill into the game, and that gives you like a big deforming advantage in the game, despite the fact that it's not really related to the game itself. Like that's my the nature of my complaint with last hitting is something like that. Does that make sense?
So I guess my take on it, I guess the argument I'd have against that is, well, first of all, as a background, I have, I think, 3,500 hours in League of Legends, something like that. You know, I've played the game quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of that at a decently high level, and so I'm pretty inside of the game. You know, I definitely don't have an unbiased opinion on this, but I guess the way I would think about it, the way I think about it is, if you look at something like Go or chess, it's not clear to me that there are physical. There's like a significant differentiation between like rote physical skills and like strategy. Because if you take Go, for example, it is reading a situation in Go. So in Go, you try to read ahead, right? So if mm-hmm. you're playing a bunch of stones, you're trying to look ahead and say, okay, white's going to play this, but black's going to play this, white's going to play this, black's going to play this. You know, move 20 from now, white's going to play this, and then he'll capture that group. And so I shouldn't play that move. And then you go back and you kind of look at other variations of that. You're like, okay, what if on move 5 white played a stone here instead of the other place? And so you look at different variations of that line and you try to read out every reasonable variation. And that as a process physically becomes a combination of intuition and skill, because you have to read out the correct lines and you have to intuitively understand the correct lines, but you also have to think about them. And so the issue I have is that really like a physical skill, or is it like a mental, you know, where's the differentiation between like the high level strategy and the low level like intuition and gut and physical skill? Because part of being good at Go is reading quickly. It's basically a skill you can study. It's exactly like you're saying, like it's a rote skill. You look at a situation, like just reading out a ladder in Go, it's a completely rote skill. Right. Or reading out a situation in Go that you've read in a book before, it's a completely rote skill. Or reading out, you know, even most,
yeah, like openings, Joseki, all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, it's really literally about how quickly, it's like your reads per second. Mm-hmm. It's like how quickly can your brain place stones on the board? And in a lot of ways, that it's basically like being able to hit a tennis ball. Like it's a physical, yeah, skill you can sit there and train, like last hitting.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's a strategy. You know what I mean? It informs your strategy, and it is your strategy. Ultimately, you're trying to read out everything, and you only rely on strategy and intuition when you can't read quickly enough or far enough ahead. You know, in the very beginning of the game when there are, you know, 300 moves to play or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I sort of see last hitting, first of all, as the waters in League of Legends are muddy to me between strategy and like physical skill. You know, I don't really see a huge differentiation between those two things, because you can also go into a game and practice looking at the map every 3 seconds. Like that's a really important skill. If you ask Faker or something how to get better at League of Legends, usually they'll say look down at the mini map every 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Because that'll tell you where everyone is. And to me at this point, I have a second sense, like an intuition when I'm playing League of Legends about what I should be doing strategically. And it's not because I sat there and like mentally thought about it consciously. You know, it's because I've played the game so much that I've developed, like last hitting, a skill of what I should do in any given situation based on my intuition and my understanding, just looking at the map and my subconscious, you know, instantly analyzes where I'm supposed to be at that moment. And so for me, last hitting is part of that spectrum that's muddy of physical, rote, and mental, strategic. So, I mean, I guess that's where I'm at on that. I sort of feel like it's not so obvious to me that they're different.
Okay, yeah. Let me, because I see what you're getting at with, I actually agree with your comparison in Go to, like, there's the broader sort of heuristic strategy of, like, I'm going to generally try to, like, take this corner or whatever, you know, like that, right, kind of, like, the strategy element. And then there's, like, the tactical elements of, like, calculating out, you know, I go here, he goes here, I go here, he goes here. Okay, that leads to me winning this interaction right here, this local interaction, right? Mm-hmm. And I agree totally that it makes sense to consider that very local tactical stuff, like a lot like a physical sort of challenge, something that you can train, something that you can kind of like grind out. There's like all these Go apps that are just like, you know, they're just like Go problems. You know what,
right,
I mean?
Yeah.
Exactly. And so that kind of stuff you can totally like grind up and bring into the game. And then like your strategy that doesn't necessarily have to be like you're gaining this advantage. So anyway, my point is I have the same problem in Go. I think Go also has a problem of bringing in this issue of calculation. I mean, that's something I talk about.
I thought I had you.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I dislike Go a lot, actually. I I think it's amazing as like a human artifact, and I think it's like I watched the AlphaGo games, and you know I appreciate obviously the incredible amount of work that goes into being a good Go player and all that kind, right, of stuff, but for me, trying to play Go is I just find it incredibly oppressive because you just have, and I also think if somebody tried to like release Go today, if somebody designed it today, I think they would, yeah, just be completely laughed off the stage. I think that people would be like, what? I'm not going to do that. Like, no way. I don't even know. The first 5 games I play, I don't even know who won. Like it's hard to even calculate the score. Like, I, you know what I mean? Like, it's very much like a, yeah, this does sound like it was designed 4,000 years ago to me.
That's funny. I don't feel that way, but I understand where you're coming from. Like, to me, there are games like today that are getting released that are like Go, like Quants. You know, Quant. Do you know that series of games?
Tsar is one of them. All of them. But those, are even still much like. There's no. You play that game the first time and you know who won. Like, it's still way more like elegant that and more like designed than Go. It seems to me.
I don't know. I think Go's pretty. I know who won. I don't really see that as an issue, but I understand what you're saying. I mean, it is a little confusing, and you do get this thing where it's like, wait, am I supposed to? Why can I play in your territory? It's like, oh no, the thing that's confusing people at Go, when I teach people Go, is like, usually they get the whole capturing thing. That's pretty straightforward, and they get the placing stones. Obviously, that's pretty straightforward, and that's most of Go. The thing that is usually confusing is in Go, you play out. So like, if you're just playing a 9x9 game of Go, you play it out. And you capture each other's stones, and you each have a bit of territory at the end of the game that's basically just empty board space that you agree is points. Mm-hmm. And that's not in the rules of Go. There's nowhere in the rules of Go that it's like, I think there might be like territory is points, but the reason territory is points is because it's an empty space that you could play in as the other player. Like, right. If white has an empty space, black could play in it, white could capture black, black could play it in again, right, white could capture black.
You need to calculate out that whole thing, basically, in order to do that.
Exactly, because each black stone captured is worth a point, in addition to the territory, playing in an area
that's already dead,
responding and taking it, is just, it's neutral, it's point neutral, right? You're capturing a stone in addition for making white play one extra stone in their territory. So, as Go players, we just agree that territory that you can't live in is free points for us.
Right, but new players have no idea what...
Exactly.
Yeah,
So, I mean, but you can play it out. Like, it does work. You don't play it out because it's boring, but if you wanted to, you could play in the other person's territory until they filled up the entire board except two eyes, you know?
Yeah.
And then you do the same, and then they do the same to you. That is allowed.
But
it's kind of like the short, we're shortcutting it. So in that sense, it's not inelegant to me.
Well,
it is a little confusing.
Yeah, I mean, new players, the thing is that, they could play it out, but they kind of have this sense of like, wait, am I just like...
Yeah, this is really stupid.
Yeah. But they don't know that it is. So they just kind of like have to do it, but they just feel this weird, like lame duck scenario. Anyway.
I think that would be the major hurdle for modern Go. Like if Go got designed, I think that would be the major hurdle. But I think, I don't know. Otherwise, to me, it's pretty elegant. I think people would still play it.
Did you play Through the Desert by Reiner Knizia?
I did, yeah.
To me, that's like a pretty good like modern Go attempt, I think. I mean,
I don't disagree. Yeah, Through the Desert's a great game. Yeah.
So anyway, back to my bigger point, though. The calculation aspect of Go is, and of every completely perfect information abstract strategy game that with no hidden information, have this problem of, it's calculation's huge. I mean, you gotta do that stuff. And it, to me, I complain about that as I would about the last hitting in League of Legends, in that, you know, cause you could have something that's like Go that did like the strategy game elements, but at least like mitigated. I'm not saying completely remove execution that would be nice, but like, I think, you know, I'm talking about reducing. I'm not talking about an absolute. So I'm like, the thing that last hitting is and the thing that calculation is in Go as a thing that's sort of separate from strategy, I'm saying it would be better if we could have less of that so that the game could be more about the strategy and so that players needed to go into some like separate application and kind of grind out this other thing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I guess, I do understand where you're coming from. For me, there are kind of two lines that I'm thinking about right now, which are kind of pulling me in opposite directions. One is that I genuinely like that stuff. I think that it's fun, and it's also extremely meditative to me. The act of getting better at a game in a way that just rewards pure effort and just sitting there and grinding it out, it's very satisfying to me. And it actually, to me, it's a hallmark of a lot of the games I enjoy. Are these games where you can sit down and you can say, like, even if the meta shifts of the game, right, completely, like it does in League of Legends. Like, I've often come to League of Legends and I have the conceptual tools to deal with it, but, you know, the game has changed completely since the last time I sat down and played it. Mm-hmm. I still have these core skills, and it gives, to me personally, it gives me an ownership over League of Legends. Like, I feel like that's my game, you know, because I can sit there and I can last hit and I can click you know, I can't dodge skill shots, right? And I can play team fights correctly and all that stuff. Like, the physical stuff about it is what makes me, I think, to me, is what endears me to League of Legends more than understanding the strategy. Like, that to me makes me feel more like a League of Legends player. And then the other side of things, the other direction that I'm thinking of, is I'm not convinced personally that there's actually any way to significantly reduce this quality of competitive games. So I guess your proposal would be that if you add in, so you this is your idea of what's the randomness? What's the version of randomness you talk about?
Well, there's input and output randomness.
Input and output randomness.
Yeah, right. So, you have the information horizon, some place at which information enters into the game, and the closer it is to you, meaning the less time you have to respond to new random information, the more it's cut, like, output randomness. Whereas, like, stuff like map generation and stuff where that you have a lot of time to respond to would be more like input randomness.
Right, and so is it output randomness is the one that reduces, like, rote skills, like last hitting? In your mind, or...
Well,
like, how do you kill last hitting, right? Because in my mind, it's like you can add randomness and you can add this stuff, but there's still always going to be people who will get edges and who will become better at the game by memorizing things and by, you know, getting better at physical skills and so on and so forth.
How do you
reduce?
Well, my proposal for last hitting, actually, it's interesting because now they have, I don't know, are you up on the latest League of Legends changes?
Yes.
Okay, so do you know about the new way that the ancient coin works? That's a support item, right?
Yeah.
And so it drops these little coins now on the field, kind of like threshold type of thing. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I would do something like that for last hitting. Like, basically, because I do think that you need a thing where... Because what I think last hitting does for the game is it makes it, you know, it creates a laning phase. It makes it so that players need to stay in an area for a while. And that gives the game, like, strategic structure, meaning, like, okay, these people are generally in this lane at this part of the game. For most of the time, which means if they leave the lane, it's like it's meaningful, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's a big part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I also think there is something there with like sort of creating like an attention thing. Like you know you kind of have to pay attention to the last hitting, but then also there's like, oh, there's people coming in to gank, and there's the other people in the lane, and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, it gives structure to the laning phase itself too. Yeah, it allows you to win the laning phase on multiple axes.
Right.
You know, you can win it by last hitting. You can win it by harassing.
Right.
Off of last hits, and actually one of the ways you get better at League of Legends is you realize that last hitting is more important than kills. That is like a major factor in good players is last hitting.
Sure. So what I would say is I'm not even advocating removing last hitting, as I'm advocating just making it better and making it more like the rest of the game. So like one problem with like last hitting is that like there's not as, I mean, sometimes the other team can do something about it, but like it's not really as like systemic as a lot of the other things. That's part of why it's so you can go into a game and just grind it out, is because it's very like, it's very just closed and very like insular. So for example, like here's my counter proposal. You, every time you kill a minion or even a minion dies, that's the way, that's the right thing. Right. And it shoots gold, like a little gold coin, like sort of back in the lane or even where it is. But probably back in the lane is maybe a little bit better, something like that. It could even be like a slightly randomized location. The point is that it makes there be a valued space on the game field that is related to this sort of economic number manipulation thing. You know what I mean? So sure. And that's already there a little bit with last hitting, because, you know, when you're last hitting, you also got to worry about, like, where am I? Am I vulnerable to harass and ganking and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yep.
But not that much. I'm basically advocating for that to be more the case, so that going into a little game, a one player custom game, is less meaningful, because now it's more about, there's more, you know what I'm saying? Do you kind of see what I'm getting at?
That's interesting. Riot agrees with you, by the way. I think Riot, you know, for the longest time they didn't have custom games, they didn't have a practice mode for that exact reason. They wanted the best way to improve at League of Legends to be playing games of League of Legends,
right?
And not
that to me is a core value of my whole like belief system in strategy games.
Yeah, and Riot definitely agrees with you. I definitely don't agree, but I do understand where you're coming from. To me, the issue becomes, well, I'm curious just on a conceptual level, like because in my mind, if you remove last hitting, something comes up to take its place, right? It's like now the important thing to get good at is this other thing, you know? And so I'm, you know, even in poker, in a game where it's like all randomness, all RNG, the thing to get good at is like understanding, putting people in hand ranges, under like remembering every move they made, and then understanding, like fitting that to various hands they could have and the strength of those hands. Like, oh, if I had this hand, would I perform this way in this exact situation? And so you can go through, like, that's a physical, that's like almost a memorization skill, right? Mm-hmm. It's like being able to quickly go through every type of range of hand they could have and matching it to their play and seeing if their behavior makes sense. And then figuring out what you're like, oh, if they have this hand and I act in this way, then I'm giving them value, or, you know, vice versa. And so in my mind, you know, there's no game more strategic than like, I don't see how you can get that much more like strategy and like thinking than poker. And so I'm interested, you know, I haven't thought about this like completely, so it's definitely possible, but I'm just interested in what you think, like, how do you actually remove that stuff without just something else coming to take its place?
Well, something else comes to take its place, but that else might be more. So, like, I believe that there's, in strategy games, there's kind of like, there's some kind of like basic core of like, what is the strategy in this game really about? Not like the little tiny, you know, small micro decisions, but the macro decisions. Like, what is this game like really about, like, fundamentally? And the more things that you tie closer to that fundamental thing that the game is about, the more of a like unified design that you have. And that's not just for like, oh, some like academic, you know, like make game designers like your game thing. It's like it's so that you know, it's the same way that like every time you add a rule, you want that rule to be doing a lot of legwork. You want that rule to be like, you don't want that rule to be adding plus 10 like complexity to the game. You want it to be like multiplying, you know, you want it to be like connected to things in a way that kind of makes it, you know, makes it be doing more than it's the sum of its parts. I don't know. I'm not.
So is there a game for you that gets this more right than League of Legends or
well, designer board games tend to be like the best. I think they tend to at least like hint at this idea the best, of like you know, of a system that really is about what it's about pretty thoroughly. But this is kind of an ideal, and it's not something that necessarily really exists. It's just something to move towards. So like, you know, it's something to like nudge in the direction of. So yeah, you're right. In League of Legends, if we did take my advice, and, you know, kind of make this like new coin drop system, yeah, there would be like, there certainly would be execution. I mean, the game is like super execution-y, but even like team fights, I don't complain about as much, because team fights feel, even though they are like, they can be super execution-y and like fighting gamey and stuff like that, they're happening on the map, and they're happening in the context that has been built throughout the match, like, you know what I mean? So like wards that have been placed, like lanes that have been pushed, like all this, towers that are up still, towers that are down, towers that are almost dead, like all that stuff is informing the team fight, whereas you making this last hit or not is like informed by just nothing except for, did you train this a lot before the game or not?
I don't agree with that necessarily. There are definitely last hits that are in that situation. Yeah, you basically free, like, when you decide to go for a last hit, which you don't always do for various reasons, because of, you know, wave control, you're trying to control the wave in a certain way, bring it closer to you, close to the enemy, slow push, freeze the wave. Or not expose yourself to the enemy to not take damage and stuff like that. But yes. At a certain point, you do decide, I'm going to last hit this creep, which is not always the case. But once you do decide that, if you miss it, it's just a physical error. Yeah.
Yeah, and so and so there's going to be something like that that would replace that with the like the coin system or whatever, but it's going to be a little bit more like team fights. It's going to be a little bit more contextually informed than just did I click at this at the exact right moment or not.
I love Last Inning. I think the coin idea is pretty good, actually. I agree with that. I think that would be interesting, too. I would like to see that.
Yeah, I mean, that to me, that plus Runes and Masteries are the two things that I think that
those are getting changed. Yeah,
they are. That's true. I'm excited about that. In general, I've been very happy about the way that things have been going with League. I don't know. Do you have a general opinion about the trajectory of the game, or?
It's good. I mean, I think it's interesting what you said earlier that I definitely made me think, which was that you can make this kind of like. League of Legends started out pretty rough, and now they've been polishing it and working on it and making it better and better. There's definitely one way to look at it, and I would agree with it. They definitely made it a lot better over time, especially over the first couple of years. I think League has hit a point in my mind where a lot of the stuff they're doing are the second type of balance changes, which are balance changes made for the sake of freshening up the game. Like, in my opinion, a lot of the stuff they've done in the last couple of years is really good, and it's well done, especially the art update for the Rift. Like, if you go and look at old League of Legends videos, you're like, holy crap,
yeah.
The game used to look this bad.
Yeah.
It's like insane that we played that.
I know.
But a lot of the updates they're doing, I think they're at a point where a decent chunk of what they're doing is just to keep players coming back. And that is sort of like, in my mind, the era we're in of esports, is you just make stuff because people get bored, you know, and over time people are going to start gravitating towards other games. And if you stop changing your game, like if you say, okay, I think this is really good and I think we've got it to a really good place and all we're going to make is these little small changes at this point. I think if you got to that point, conceptually, you would still make big changes these days, at least, because that's what people want. They want a game that's constantly changing. They want to be engaged by new champions, new ideas, old champions that are different, and each time they come back, they want something different. I think that's the current era of esports we're in right now.
Yeah, okay, let me push back on that, because first of all, I should say, I have asked the lead designer about that specific thing, because that is something that concerns me. I think it's really bad if people get to a point where they are just making changes just to keep stuff fresh. And I was, I have been concerned about that being the case at Riot somewhat, because I actually saw one of their design videos. One of their designers actually used that language. He said something like, we want to keep stuff fresh, blah, 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 blah. And I was like mortified, like, because to me, that means... That literally means we're going to make the game worse.
It does. Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Yeah, because if it was already...
From one perspective, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it has to... It, from their perspective, that's the important thing. Because they're... Right? Because, yeah. So that's... And, like, we're trusting you. As a game designer, like, when I play a game designer's game, I am saying, okay, I trust you. You're an expert. You've set up these rules in such a way that you think is optimal, and that's what you do with your life, is, like, try to come up with optimal rules. So I will follow you, and I will play by the rules that you have prescribed. It's like this trusting thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so to hear them say, we're just trying to keep it fresh. I think that's bad. And I pose that strongly, but I'm not super convinced. They tell me that they definitely don't do that. And that they like oppose that idea, that they try really hard not to do that. However,
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, there are certain things that they do. Like, for example, they're adding new champions. So, like, obviously adding new champions is doing that, like, to some extent, right? Like, to some extent, you know, the game probably doesn't need... What does it have? 156 champions at this point?
We need to get up to 300 or else it's...
Right. It's hard for me to believe that the ideal version of the game needs more characters than this. But whatever. So they are doing that in that. That's, like, pretty undeniable. But that also could be... You could argue that, you know, I mean... putting that aside for a second. The other changes that they're making, I mean, they're... Like, for example, the dragon changes. I feel like the idea that we would assume that they're just making changes to keep stuff fresh makes, like, I feel like that assumes a very low cap for how good games can be, because, like, you know, Dota came out of, like, it was this weird accident, like, mod thing that kind of came out of, like, this other game, and, you know, like, it makes sense to me that we could probably do way better than League of Legends, like, that you know, theoretically, in like, you know, another 10, 20, 30 years, that we could improve on League of Legends dramatically from where it is now. So, like, for example, the dragon changes, how they've changed those, and by the way, I was, like, fawning, because in their video, I don't know if you saw it, but in their video, they use the terms input and output randomness.
Do they really?
Yeah, they talk about that. Awesome. Because the dragons, the way they work is, you know, it spawns random ones, but you get this icon that shows you what kind of dragon is going to spawn next, kind of like a Tetris next box or something. And that's input randomness. That's beyond
name drop to you.
Yeah, they should have. It would have been awesome. Yeah. But I don't care. I mean, you Google input randomness or output randomness, and, like, I'm the top, like, three pages on Google or whatever. So, even though it was, I should say, I took the terms from the Ludology podcast. You ever listen to them? Jeff Engelstein? Yeah. They, I believe they coined the terms. But anyway, so I should mention that. But, So, what was I saying? Completely lost my train of thought. League of Legends is...
You were talking about how the freshness versus updating for depth.
Yeah, so...
There can be a much better game than League of
Legends. Yeah, there could be a much better game. I mean, the dragon change, that's a really good change. Like those, you know, the ancient coin change, that's a really good change. I mean, it's getting better. Like, to me, it seems like a lot... I mean, maybe you can think of some change that to you just felt like, oh, that's not necessarily better. It's either equal value or worse. And
no, I agree with you. I do think it's getting better. And I my argument would definitely not be that they're not improving it. It's that a significant portion of the value they're gaining from changing the game is freshness. Like, it's not all of it. Maybe not even the majority. Hmm. But it does seem to me, at least, to be the ecosystem we're in particularly in esports, but also sort of holistically in games today. And maybe it's a problem, but I have a hard time believing. Maybe League of Legends is the one exception, but I think if you look holistically at the games industry, you'll see games that are constantly getting updated. And it's not just because the updates are making them better.
Okay, actually, sorry, go on.
Oh, yeah, I just mean, like, you know, everything's like, everything is getting patched these days. Everything has to be an evergreen game. And I don't think that's the best thing for maybe it's the best thing for a lot of games, but I don't think they're always getting, I think a lot of the motivation for these changes from developers is not, let's make our game perfect and let's really refine it strategically. I think it's, we update our game and people come back to it and people get interested in it again and people, you know, stop getting bored by it, you know, and stay with us, regardless of whether or not the update makes it deeper or shallower.
So this actually is really cool because it goes back to our previous conversation about how do you market something. So in this case, you know, like game designers understand that they need to make the game better, right? And in patches, right? But people in general, that's not necessarily what they care about. They are actually interested in, I want something new. I want something different than what I played before. And so the marketing of, and maybe the part of the motivation for making these changes is also informed by this, like, what do people sort of want or say they want or think they want or, you know, sort of thing. So it's that same kind of dichotomy of, like, what actually is of value to, like, the strategy game design in this sort of formal way, and then what are the expectations and what are the things that people think they want. So yeah, I think I agree with you that you're saying the motivation, so like the effect may be they are just making the game better and that's what they're working on and that's what they're doing, but the motivation for doing that is not making the game better. The motivation for doing that is making the game fresher.
I think it's a combination of the two, for sure. I think it depends on the designer largely. I mean, I don't think all designers are even interested in, like, polishing their game to a gem, even if it's a strategy game. Mm-hmm. I think some people are genuinely just like, yeah, people like playing my game. It's a fun game, and they want more of it. You know, they want, you know, even if it's, like, a watered-down version or different or, you know, like, crazy or whatever. You know, some people are, I think, more interested in making, even strategy game designers, some of them are more interested in making, you know, real life things, you know, like let's add let's add some more realism to our game, or let's add some more real life stuff, right? Like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if we had tanks in this game, you know, sure. or whatever, right? I think there are a lot of motivations that don't come directly from, you know, I think that is like a unique thing about you in a lot of ways, is that you have this incredibly focused viewpoint on making the game strategically as deep as it could be. And I think that's part of the reason I really like talking to you about this stuff, right? Is because I do think you have an extremely unique take on it. But I've definitely met a lot of strategy game designers who work on games that you would expect the primary motivation to be making it deeper, but they're actually interested in something else, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you totally. That is how people think. I mean, you know, video games are largely sort of like content/variety, certainly marketed, and you know, back of the box kind of values are like, we're just, I don't know, we're kind of like cooked in that soup a little bit. So like,
absolutely, no question.
Yeah. Okay. So want to wrap up in a little bit, but I want to ask you two more quick questions. One is I've talked to you about this at GDC a little bit, but I want to talk to you just really briefly about game design writing and the state of that whole world, and whether you are, because I've been trying to like get people into writing about game design. I'm trying to like advocate for that, and you know, I want more people to do that. I think it's a part of how we make the discipline better. Do you have anything to say about that? Like, what, like, because I feel like that sort of has like really leveled off in the last few years. Do you have any plans to do any game design writing of your own?
Definitely. I dip in and out. I think I, from time to time, I get super into it, get super into a piece. And I think in general, my favorite stuff to read is stuff, your stuff. And I genuinely mean that. I mean, like, you know, for me, it really is. I like reading the meaty stuff that's really, it feels like it has a thesis, right? Like, I like your stuff because it comes from a place of someone who thinks differently from me and is willing to embrace that, you know, and your stuff and Dan Cook's stuff feels like that. David Sterling's stuff feels like that. Like, you guys have,
those two don't really produce a lot of articles anymore.
It's true. They used to, though, right?
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
A lot of good stuff on Lost Garden and a lot of good stuff on Sirlin.net.
Totally.
And that stuff is really powerful for me. Raph Koster, I think, mm-hmm. is also really interesting the way he thinks about stuff. And so I feel in a lot of ways, like, for me to get into games writing, I need to figure out, like, where I stand philosophically on games holistically. And I still feel like personally I'm bouncing around a lot. Like, sure. I'll wake up one day and I'll be like, okay, the only important thing is making a popular game. And then, like you said, I'll make a popular husk, and then I can figure out what to do with it later.
Sure.
And then the next day I'm like, oh, popularity doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Like, I'm totally like, I'm bouncing around all over the place mm-hmm. creatively. And a lot of that, I think, is being cooked in the soup, like you're saying. It's what are my core values here? What am I trying to accomplish and what am I trying to achieve? And it's definitely a Maslow's style problem, where it's like, you know, it's one of those basic, it's like a high level of actualization that I'm going to need to achieve and think about my entire life. I think I'm never going to like, I don't think any of us are going to solve this problem.
No. You know, yeah.
Should a game be popular? All this stuff. You know, I'm definitely in a formative place there. So I think that's the difficulty for me in games writing, is mm-hmm. I still need to like make more games and figure out what's actually important to me. And who knows, maybe, you know, like years down the road, I'll be like, I don't see myself this way, but you know, maybe I'll be like a marketing guru. Right. And the thing I'm interested in is like speaking to people. Cause I think there is value in being able to talk to people and see what people are interested in and give them what they're interested in. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think for me, the next couple of games I make, the big games especially, are going to be really formative in determining what I would want to write about. And so that's the hard part for me for games writing.
Cool. Well, I really look forward to those. And the last,
thank you.
Yeah, the last, I mean, I'm a, you know, I'm a huge fan of your work, as I've mentioned, and I will definitely play everything you ever make from here on out.
Oh, I appreciate that so much. Thank you, Keith. That means a lot to me.
So I also wanted to mention, so we have this situation, you know, like there 30, 40 years ago, maybe 50 years ago, somewhere in that ballpark, there wasn't a human being on the planet whose job title was game designer. And certainly if he did exist, he was literally the first one, and there was no institution at all or support or cultural like identity or anything at all to inform him other than his own experiments. Okay, so with that in mind, I kind of wanted to ask you, because, you know, you and you're kind of like the first generation of people who could, and maybe this is something you've been asked about before, but, you know, I know we didn't mention this on the thing, but, you know, your father, Frank Lance, has been on this podcast twice. He's a cool guy. He's a game designer. And what was it? I mean, do you have anything like that's kind of interesting that like, and I also sort of when I saw Mercury and how awesome it was, I was kind of like, oh, yeah, well, this guy was raised by a game designer. Like, that's not something that happens. Like, that's a pretty weird, rare thing. I mean, it's going to become less rare, but that's an interesting thing. So, like, do you feel like that informed your, like, did you think in a game design-y way at like a young age? And like, I don't know, like, can you talk a little bit about that and how that informed you?
Absolutely. I think it's one of the cornerstones of how I design games is growing up talking with my dad and being interested in that stuff. And, you know, in a lot of ways, getting to that point where you're thinking about, because I think everyone gets to a point when they start playing games, they get into games where they start thinking about like, oh, what's the meaning behind this? And how did they do this way? And how did they achieve, you know, I'm sad now, or I'm happy, or I feel compelled to play this more. How did they achieve that? Why is that the case? You know, and what are they doing here, and trying to peek behind the curtain? And having someone to talk to about that, who's extremely smart and extremely insightful into why those things exist, really jump-started me. And I think for a very long period of time, I got to the point where I was asking those questions and I had answers. You know, I had at least, you know, what Frank was thinking, what my dad was thinking about that stuff as answers. And so for me, it was like I really got to somewhere where I played games critically, I think, super quickly and then forever. You know, I was like, I was definitely got to a certain point where I was like, okay, I'm always going to play games critically from this point on. You know, I think a lot of people ask those questions and they don't really have a framework for answering them. And then they kind of like, whatever, I'll just play it and not worry about it.
Yeah.
For me, I think that was super formative. And a lot of the thing I feel like I'm good at is this insight, you know, the kind of intuition stuff where it's like, oh, I because I've played so many games critically and because I've thought about this stuff my entire life, you know, I have kind of like the Go equivalent of a strong reading sensibility. You know, I can read moves ahead in a game, right?
Jimi Hendrix of game design.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. I'm the Jimi Hendrix of game design.
Yeah, no.
The dad who played guitar? Probably, right?
Yeah. Probably, yeah. A lot of dads play guitar, but yeah.
That's true. A lot of dads do play guitar. That's the point I want to come across in this podcast. Just label it, I'm the Jimi Hendrix of game design.
Yeah, I may have to put that somewhere in the show notes at some point. That's one of the bullet points. That's cool. I mean, yeah, that's really interesting that, have you guys, made a game together, the Word one, right?
Yeah, Antigrams. Yeah, we made that together. And Mercury is a co-op project too. My dad did all the art for that. And a lot of ways, I mean, I think to counterbalance that, my greatest strength in that point being my like game sense, my game reading, my ability to see design moves ahead is also my greatest weakness, is that I don't have, and what I'm trying to develop is like, I don't have a sense of, you know, what super good art style or a super good sensibilities or like, oh, this is going to be popular or that kind of thing. I think that's my greatest weakness as a game designer right now, is the stuff that, you know, like I would have a really hard time making a game like Firewatch or making a game like Abzu or like Gone Home or a lot of these games, or like Papers, Please, stuff like that, where it's like super stylish, super insightful. And this person like clearly has something to say from outside of games, right? Like they're an outsider to games. They came in, they made this game, and they're or maybe not an outsider, but you know, they're drawing from life experience in this other way. And because I've spent my entire life immersed in the games culture soup, and all this other stuff, I feel like in a lot of ways I'm spending a lot of my career, early on at least, trying to reach outside and figure out what I'm good at pulling stuff into games, but I'm not good at figuring out yet what I want to pull into games and what you should want to pull into games, right? And so that for me is, I think, the thing I'm trying to figure out in a lot of ways.
That's good. Yeah, that's a really good thing. I mean, the insularness of being a gamer, you know, growing up.
Yeah, especially a second generation game designer, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, no, that's definitely a good thing to worry about and think about. And I mean, there's a whole other conversation there, I think. But, yeah, we should wrap up because I got to turn my AC back on. It's like a million degrees in here, and my AC is really loud. So,
yeah, I hope that the sounds and sights of downtown Vancouver haven't been too loud here.
No, it's. I think I heard one Vancouver policeman driving by. Oh, that was about it. Okay, cool. Well, James, thank you so much for coming on. This has been really good. And
thank you so much for having me, Keith. Great talk. I love talking to you.
Cool. Anytime. Well, we'll do it again for sure.
Cheers. I can't wait.
All right, I'll see you.
All right, see you, Keith.
This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.